You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and here we are at part two of my conversation with Jade Dellinger, an independent curator and now director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery at Florida Southwestern State College, formerly Edison State College. There's much to talk about with Jade, and part one, which aired last Saturday night, July 3, focused much on his interesting personal history, as well as his rather unusual installation of John Cage's 33 and a Third at the Tampa Art Museum Tempest Projects in 2012 as part of the larger exhibition entitled Things Not Seen Before, A Tribute to John Cage, which was later seen at the National Gallery of Art in Tbilisi, Georgia. Tonight, we focus on this larger exhibition, and our conversation extends to include his unusual findings as a collector, many of which found their way into this exhibition. Jade also speaks a bit about his upcoming exhibition, Don't Blame It on Zen, John Cage and Friends, which will be seen at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center this fall, in tandem with its 12th annual Reviewing Black Mountain College International Conference, taking place November 12 to 14 in Asheville, North Carolina. We'll listen at the close of tonight's program to something that doesn't exactly relate to Jade Dellinger, but rather fits nicely into the category of things not heard before. A little-known pre-concert talk given by the late American composer Richard Teitelbaum at our John Cage at Bard College Symposium in 2009. Teitelbaum died in 2020, and his co-founder of the important live acoustic electronic improvisation group formed in 1966 in Rome, known as Musica Electronica Viva, or MEV, Frederick Jevski died this past week. I was flooded with memories of them both and their important work. So welcome to All Things Cage, Jade. This is part two of our conversation that aired last Saturday night. Did you enjoy hearing us on the radio?
It was such fun. It was really great. and always a pleasure to be able to spend more time with you. So I'm delighted to see you again this week.
You're very, very generous. There were so many things that got left unsaid in that show. Mm. We spent most of our time happily, really, talking about 33 and a Third, which was such a lively, such a popular event. So I'm glad that we were able to do that. But we didn't actually get to Things Not Seen Before, which was the show that you produced for Tampa, which also speaks to, or when we talk about it, we can speak a little bit to something I raised, which is your collecting activities and the things that you found, because several things that ended up in that show, of course, you collected along the way. And that was the beginning of our relationship, actually. Shall we start there? We could start with recounting the fact that I think the first time I ever heard from you is when you wrote to me and sent me information, if not also pictures, of the artist Conks. And you were trying to figure out what these were. So for our listening audience, we should probably explain what an artist conch is. Why don't you talk to us about what you found and where you found them?
Well, speaking more broadly about the kind of collecting thing, one of the things that was so wonderful that sort of stuck with me was, you know, those early exchanges that I had with Cage and also the things that he sent, because not only have I, of course, saved his correspondence, those few letters and the little questionnaire with the sort of simple answers, but that we talked about last week, but because I would put things in these sort of larger packages and register them, forcing you and or he to go to the post office, one was the questionnaire actually was tucked in an envelope. And when it came back from Cage, much to my amazement, he had traced his hand on the exterior of the envelope. So it came back to me with this sort of drawn tracing of Cage's hand. And it was something that always resonated. I always felt his presence would always be with me because of this tracing of his hand.
Interesting. You know, Jade, that I was thinking about this after the show. I was thinking about the fact that I believe I remember the book that you sent that you wanted Cage to contribute to. I remember that sitting on the front table for a long time and wondering when he would ever get to it. But Now that you say that, I also remember this would have been around the time that somebody sent him a particular pen and a particular piece of paper and needed his hand tracing. Because she, it was a woman, I'd have to look this up. I'm sure we have the book in our archives. It was a book with the hand tracings of all of her favorite artists. Oh, so wow. He was in this spirit, I presume, at the time.
Yeah. Well, I've learned from you since that he had done a number of those sort of tracings of his hand. That was something that was not infrequently done. I was always also really interested because, you know, these autograph dealers who would be trading in my great grandfather's and other baseball players' autographs, occasionally I would pick up from them signatures that had come from Cage that you know, I could trade a Mickey Mantle signature for a John Cage. And those things were never identified properly because I think at some point, Cage had made an edition that was published in Japan, and it was kind of a large edition. It was actually a work that was called Tribute to John Cage by Nam June Paik, right? And mm-hmm. Nam June had made a set of cards, and you may
right.
recall
we have
that.
Several sets here.
Exactly,
and yeah, they're playing cards with a picture of Cage. He did them for a variety of artists, actually. I don't know how many, but we have Merce, we have John.
One of the wonderful kind of things that always spoke to me about the way that he responded to fan mail and apparently autograph requests was that he would pull at random one of those cards from one of his personal decks, and that he would often, if someone I think must have been requesting a photograph signed or something like that, he would send them a playing card, you know, and each one then is unique, but they're hand signed by Cage. And what amazed me at the beginning of trying to pick up these whenever they would surface, because, you know, I realized that they were actually works by Nam June that were editioned and screen printed cards, but they were also from Cage's personal deck. You know,
so that's exactly right. And Jade, you know, it's fun that you're telling me this, because this explains why. After he died, and we pulled the John Cage Trust, was started with all the residue of his life that was in his loft, which included a handful of these decks. And one of them was incomplete.
Yes. Well, I have a few if you need them. Uh-huh. And the ones I have are hand signed by him, but came from, kind of autograph collectors around the world who would write to him for a signature. But anyway,
it's kind of in keeping with Cage's behavior, because it would disseminate Nam June a little bit. You know, it would make people aware of Nam June's deck of cards.
I think, and most didn't know that or understand that. They thought it was a playing card, clearly an image of Cage. But I realized that, I think, quite early on. I thought, you know, well, this is actually becomes a kind of collaboration. And also, I love the thought that each of these that surfaced was always different, because it was from the 52 cards in the deck that he was distributing, dispersing all over. But similarly, you know, sort of following those things, there had been a kind of online auction, and this is where we were sort of cut off with the last conversation. There had been a online auction, and I had seen these interesting specimens, these mushrooms that had surfaced, that as I understood the story, it was a deceased relative who had some connection that may have been a member of the New York Mycological Society, but who had been on these first outings. And I didn't understand how it was possible, one, that 50 years later they would still exist, but there is this sort of tree mushroom that
I'm going to save you a lot of work, because at the time that you did the show, I did a little blog about things not seen before. So I'm going to read from the blog. Dellinger is also a discerning collector. His most recent acquisition is a pair of artist conchs. And for those of you in the listening audience, that's spelled C-O-N-K with an S for the plural. Artist conchs, which is what mycologically savvy folks have nicknamed the common tree bracket fungus, otherwise known as the, looks like Ganoderma aplanatum. The moniker is apt, because one of the properties of this particular fungus is that its pore surface accepts and preserves whatever is etched onto the surface. As you can see, and I've included pictures, which by the way, I'll put on our broadcast page for people to see these, Dellinger's artifacts have tremendous historical significance, being signed and dated by original members of the New York Mycological Society, which, as most know, Cage co-invigorated with Guy Meering and others in 1962. One of the conchs is dated Memorial Day 1962, and it is from their inaugural mycological jaunt and is signed by each of the founding members, including Cage, Lois Long, Dick and Allison Higgins, and Guy Meering. Right. Talk about longevity, no?
Incredible, yeah.
So this is a good moment for us to pause and let you finish the story about Allison Higgins.
About Allison, yeah. So these objects that surfaced that had been in a shoebox in someone's attic for almost 50 years, I included then as I was working on, you know, the Things Not Seen Before exhibition, just because, again, they were just such a remarkable thing that they existed, and that, as I understood the New York Mycological Society, there weren't a lot of formalities. There was, I think, a secretary. There was never a president. There was no, you know, I mean, he was seen as co-founder, but as best
really
I could
founder.
Tell.
It's, you know, I don't mean to interrupt you, but yeah. The New York Mycological Society was founded long before then. So it was just revitalized. It was really John and Guy Meering kind of together saying, let's regroup on this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, because in 2012, there was an exhibition as well at Cooper Union that was organized by the Mycological Society celebrating their 50th anniversary. So they felt that 1962 date was the reemergence, the reforming, the, you know, and that they were attributing much of that to Cage. I think that the trust at that point also lent the Lois
Mushroom
Long
book.
Mushroom book.
You know, Jade, it was more than we lent. We have three of the original artist portfolio known as Mushroom Book, which has these beautiful drawings, ink drawings of mushrooms by Lois Long. John Cage does the text. It's a very beautiful set, but it doesn't show well because it's on different kinds of paper that overlay each other. So you can't actually see it without handling it. You have to turn the pages yourself.
Yeah.
But we have three of them. So we tore one of them apart, literally, so that we could hang each of the 10 folios, each of which has three pages that are normally folded on top of the inner page. So we tore one apart just so we could hang the damn thing. But
and that was such a lovely thing with the, you know, the Atelier Edition's recent mycological foray book, to be to reproduce that so that people could have it in hand without, you know, gloves.
Yes, so. Of course. My only complaint is that it's so small. The mushroom, because the portfolio is good. I don't know what the scale is, but it's at least 2.5 times larger.
Definitely.
You know, so it's more grand. It has more grandeur to it. But yeah, you're not wrong. I'm very grateful that they did that, because people can now actually see that's exactly what it looks like in the portfolio with that page.
And to be able to handle it. Yeah, that's true. The when you lent those for the Mycological Society's 50th anniversary, I lent these artist conchs at that point.
I remember.
They were quite interested in that. And in the Things Not Seen Before exhibition, I included the conchs because I felt, one, those exhibitions didn't overlap. So I was able to lend the actual objects with then the, you know, for my exhibition in Tampa. And I included in the exhibition in Tampa a few of the trial proofs from the Mushroom Book. So when originally printed, they were published by Irwin Hollander, of course, and they were Cage's contributions as well as Lois Long's were lithographs. And I had managed to contact the original printer, who is living in Ireland, and he had a few of those trial proofs that were left. So I was able to get a few of those things from him, which are nice in that well, they're lacking obviously the folios, but they are, it didn't have to be torn apart because they were,
right.
you know, independent sheets that yep. were signed and, you know, that sort of thing. So those two will be in the exhibition at Black Mountain College that's coming up as well. But the funny story was when then later I made this exhibition, Fluzuzic, at Fluxus Music at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery a few years ago, I brought Allison Knowles and I showed her the conch because it was in one of our vitrines in the exhibition. And much to her amazement, as she looked at it, she was taken aback. I said, you know, the signature is here. And it is inscribed in the same hand, which seems very clearly to be Cage's hand, which is quite wonderful. So he's listing off the names of those participants in at that first event. And if there ever were kind of a founding document or document of that first excursion, you know, it seems like this is it. And I don't know how many might have been made, you know, for other participants. I've never seen another, certainly. And this was a great surprise to me. And it seemed to be to you as well. But when I showed Allison, we were reading through the names and John Cage signs his own name. And then, you know, it's Guy Nearing and it's Lois Long. And then it said Dick and Allison Higgins. And Allison sort of stopped and said, how typical of John, because she had been newly married, I suppose, but seeing her name as Higgins really, you
That's
know.
That's why I said Allison Knowles. Right.
Exactly. So that was fun.
Very sweet. Yeah. The other artist conch that you have is headed Londonderry, Vermont. That one memorializes what was for many years the favored location of the New York Mycological Society's annual Chanterelle Weekend. And I don't know that you remember this. You must have this in your files. When you first approached me about these conchs, they were indeed news to me. I'd never even heard of an artist conch, number one, and certainly not, you know, ones connected to the Mycological Society. But I remember sending you on to Paul Zadowski.
Yes.
And Paul Zadowski had been for many years Cage's engraver, his music engraver. And after John died, found himself a bit at a loss and told me once that becoming a forager and joining the New York Mycological Society was a lifesaver, that it gave him a sense of camaraderie, something that John loved. He learned to love it exactly the same way. He's a very interesting guy. But anyway, he was able to tell us, you know, what that second artist conch memorialized, which is lovely.
Absolutely.
And then I think he put your pictures and wrote about it in the New York Mycological Newsletter after that.
Oh, he did?
I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's news to me. I'll have to look that up. That's great. Well, and you know, those kinds of things, I think just, you know, I've always been kind of fascinated by those. One of the other early things that I managed to track down to do with Cage was also a copy of his high school yearbook, which as I then was discovering, of course, you know, his misostics, that seemed to be, I don't know if you know that bit of it, or I think maybe Ken Silverman talks about it, but in his senior yearbook, which is of course Los Angeles High School, summer of 1928, he's photographed in that summer issue. And the high school was so big, they had summer and winter graduations also at the time. But I managed to track down, you know, this high school yearbook. And one of the things that I was sort of shocking to me was that each of the students in the senior class, beside their name, they made an acrostic using the name of their mascot, which was Romans. So for Cage, it actually had Romans, and then they would sort of fill in. So the R in Romans was recreation, and Cage answered orating. And for occupation next, he just said working. And for mischief in Romans, he said studying. And for aspiration, he said to earn a DD and PhD. So the Doctor of Divinity, as I'm thinking about how his early path, and then also as it relates to his, you know, his religious studies and interest in Zen, you know, that seems quite important. But then also the N was always noted for. So they asked the students what they would be noted for. And he said, being radical. So, but amazing to me, because again, thinking about his misostic writing, you know, that even in that early form, that in his yearbook, you know, they had these acrostics, and that he was having to sort of respond to the acrostic as everyone
right,
else.
Right. Did. Going back to his autograph for a second, Jade, I just had another memory just flitted across my head. Have you ever come across, Cage went through a period around the same time. I want to say it was in the late 80s, because I was around, where he would do, he would sign his name like in quadruple. He
Multiple times. Do
it three or four times, kind of on top of each other. So it echoed.
Yes.
Did you ever see this?
Like, hold, I've seen a few of those where it looks like he's holding a handful of pens or
and
something.
He's not. He just wrote his name on top of each other.
That's great. Well, one of the works that we'll include in the Don't Blame It on Zenex edition in Asheville coming up is actually a work that was a collaborative work with Ann Hamilton and with Andrew Deutsch. And one of the things that they've done, it had to do with sort of microphoning her body and microphoning this paper. And I'm hopeful that exhibition is going to be this about being experiential. It's not about illustrating this kind of theme or trying to pick works that necessarily represent, you know, Buddhist philosophy but this is an interactive sort of drawing kiosk where you're listening to these sounds that Anne and Andrew composed. But she made the drawing initially by bunching together lots of pencils, so different writing implements. And she makes this very large drawing using, you know, a handful. So it's really an interesting, and it looks quite like, you know, those
interesting
signatures occasionally where Cage was doing just that. But
So what else was in the Things Not Seen Before exhibition?
Things Not Seen Before was really an effort, I think, on my part, not only to celebrate, you know, the centenary, but also I had just been discovering these connections. I mean, for me, it was some of the artists, both of my generation and slightly before, the Christian Marclays, the Stephen Vitiellos, the Andrew Deutsches, you know, they were people that I was beginning to really work with and to make some exhibitions with, and they had their own personal stories that connected with Cage, but it also sort of took me into the constellation of Fluxus. And so I included their work, and they were participants in it and often making work, and, you know, people like Lee Rinaldo and others. And then it really seemed important to me to focus a good bit on those Fluxus pioneers who had these close connections. So, you know, the Alison Knowles, you know, Jeffrey Hendricks, Ben Patterson, Yoko Ono, Philip Korner, they were all included in that exhibition, often in the form of you know, a variety of scores or things that could be interpreted. We had folks come in at various stages and perform some of those works. But, you know, I think they became, you know, even that artist group of folks that were kind of my generation, they also became my teachers. It was a situation where, you know, talking to Stephen Vitiello about his collaborations with Nam June Paik, and, you know, he of course has later curated the Silences exhibition at MoMA, and with Christian, of course, there were these connections. I was discovering, you know, Christian's work and then drawing comparisons to Joe Jones and to Milan Knežak, and so Knežak and Joe Jones became a part of the show, and around that time, or just prior, I had flown off to Prague to try to convince Milan Knežak to be in an exhibition with Christian and for the Contemporary Art Museum. So we had done a project already with both and together. And then, you know, as a result of that, I mean, I think when I got to the Rauschenberg Gallery, it really influenced and informed my programming moving forward. But in that way, you know, Cage was the start of it all, you know, and really influenced and connected, you know, thinking about his time at the New School and how all of those people, once he had joined the faculty, certainly in 1956 or whatever, had either officially or unofficially attended his lectures there. So, you know, that has been endlessly of interest and fascination for me, I think.
And let me clarify for our listeners, when you say Christian, you're talking about Christian Marclay.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. whenever anyone says Christian in conjunction with Cage, they think Christian Wolff.
So
the
of course.
Minute you said that, I thought, you studied Christian Wolff? That's amazing. And I always meant to ask you, was the you had one or two strings pieces.
Yes.
Cage made in his visual artwork output over his life. He made these very Duchamp-inspired works called strings, where
based on three standard stoppages.
That's exactly right. And he dipped this cut cotton string into paint and then dropped them from a ladder onto the printing press. And then they were pressed into the paper. And Christian Markley has become quite a collector of Cage's strings. He's one of the few people that really appreciated these works long before anybody else.
Thanks to me.
Is that right? That's so great.
So actually what happened, which is, he came to Tampa and participated in Things Not Seen Before. He saw the strings work. And I had the great good fortune of acquiring one. And essentially what had happened was they were relatively unknown and interestingly, like not a part of the discussions about Cage's visual art for some time. They were literally left out often. And part of that, I think, probably had to do with the folks, our friends, Catherine Brown and others at Crown Point Press, where they believed that in order to make, you know, a sort of fine art print, you had to have a master printer. And the way that these works were made, they were made in collaboration sort of with students, although Cage was both the printer and the, you know, he created both the matrix and was involved in the printing, but there were students involved. This was done at the New Arts program in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. And Jim Carroll and Kermit Oswald. Kermit was best friends with Keith Haring. He went to New York for a time, came back, and he wrote a letter to Cage inviting him. And Jim Carroll, who was running the program, thought that was a great idea. Cage timed his visit, as I think he often did. Same was true with the Mountain Lake Workshop, to go when there was good mushroom hunting. And in doing so, he began work with the students, and he had an idea in mind, which again, as you're saying, you know, using chance operations, he determined the width of the ropes, the length of the ropes, the types of paint that they'd be dipped into. And I had met the student, in fact, that had played chess with Cage. So before his arrival, Jim Carroll, knowing that Cage would want to play chess, had the students have a competition to actually see who was the best chess player to put up against Cage daily when he wanted to play chess. So this student, who then ended up receiving one of these prints that I ultimately then acquired, and he kind of gave me the backstory. And I was quite surprised, because I think in the 90s, while in New York, I would go to Crown Point Press and I would see the exhibitions of Cage's latest, you know, or the production that he had made over decades since the 70s at Crown Point, which were always extraordinary, but that I had never really heard of the strings works. There is a kind of funny backstory in that when Cage got there, when the students arrived, you know, they were all given these kinds of assignments to assist him. One purely dedicated to being at the chessboard. There was another student who actually, there were two students in the class that were of age to buy alcohol. And immediately it became clear that it was important that each day Cage had Glenn Levitz and to be able to have, you know, alcohol on hand. And the students, they were delighted because he shared. So they all got to drink the alcohol, but also they thought, well, gosh, this is very strange. He seems to be a bit of a lush, you know, and because he was drinking, you know, seemingly uncharacteristically heavily. And, as it turned out, they would later learn that Cage actually had tested this out the night before. He had climbed the ladder and he'd fallen from it and actually landed. You've not heard the story.
God,
I'm seeing from your face. Okay, so he had actually climbed the ladder to test out the dropping of strings from on top of this like 8 to 10 foot ladder, and he had fallen onto the press. And you know, a press is not very giving. Right. So they would later learn that he was self-medicating with the alcohol because he didn't want to disappoint them. And he wanted to participate in the project, but he had gone back to New York and had broken a rib.
Oh, no.
So he was in intense pain, and he must have been, you know, I mean, he was in his 70s by then. So it's this kind of remarkable story about that happening. And they produced two bodies of work. There were two series of these strings monotypes. There were 63, I believe, in the first series, and they're extraordinary. And the one that I received, was able to acquire, was one of those 63. And then I knew I came in contact with soon thereafter, as I began to do research, with the classmate who had been the one to buy him the alcohol. So she gave me her story, and she had a print, one of those prints, to sell. So Christian Markley, as he was coming for Things Not Seen Before, and to be in Tampa, Christian saw my strings monotype. And I said, Christian, you know, it's a little out of my price range, but there's another that's available at the moment that if you're interested in, I'd be happy to put you in contact with this former student who wants to sell her strings monotype. So I did that. And in the meantime, the next time Christian was down and we were together, I said to him that I've been in touch now too with Jim Carroll, who had founded the New Arts Program at Kutztown. And the 63 strings monotypes had been distributed. They'd been broken up as a set, but the 20 remained, the second series remained together, and quite intentionally from Jim's perspective that they should stay together. And in fact, Jim offered me them, for sale if I was interested and if I would promise to keep them together. And while the price was comparatively to the current market very modest, it was way more than I could afford. So as it turned out, over dinner, I made mention to Christian that as much as he and I both loved our one strings monotype, that ideally one would be in a position to buy this set of 20 and that had been kept together. So turned out, you know, I sort of gave him that information. And the next time I saw him, about 6 months later, Christian admitted to me, he said, I think I owe you quite a big thanks, which is that I managed to buy the entire set of those strings monotypes.
I had no idea.
Well, and then he said the remarkable part about that, and the thing that was kind of most mind-blowing to him, was that Jim Carroll, in selling him them, when he sent them, it included all of Cage's tools. So it had with it, with that set, all of the inked strings and paint covered strings and everything that he had used to make that series. So fortunately, it ended up in the hands of, you know, an artist and collector who I greatly admire, but I kicked myself a bit for having turned him on to it and not being able to.
Has he ever shown everything en masse?
I think he did. I think he maybe lent them to that show at the Philadelphia Museum that Carlos Basualdo
curated. The one where, yes.
With Duchamp. Yeah, Duchamp, Cage.
The Bride, Dancing Around the Bride. Are you talking about that one with Cage and Cunningham? And yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. So I think they were included there, and that was soon thereafter. And I think by then he knew that I'd see them in the catalog. So yes. He had to
fess up.
Yeah. And yeah, buy me dinner.
That's
or whatever.
Right. I did see them there. You're not wrong.
But
I just have this memory of when I discovered Christian's works, and I didn't see them all en masse all at one time, but I just remember seeing one and then another and then another and thinking, wow, and he got all the really the best ones, you know,
right.
Somehow that set was really particularly stellar.
Yeah. Well, and no one had really seen them. I mean, I think that they had been retained by, you know, by the program and by Jim Carroll. And I think from the conversations that I had with those in that circle, they felt slighted always on some level, I believe, because, you know, that work, they're remarkable, they're incredible prints. I mean, it was never really being acknowledged, that whenever there would be an exhibition of Cage's prints or whenever there would be discussion of his visual art. I mean, case in point, even looking at the catalog, the New River watercolors, when it was at the Virginia Museum of Art, when you, in the back of the catalog, it lists the visual arts and it's every date to that point with the additions that were done. It talks about, of course, the New River watercolors, and it talks about each series of works that he did with Kathan at Crown Point Press, but that has completely been left out. Yes. Because there was no master printer involved, but I think that's the beauty of this, really, too, you know, and the story's great about, you know, sadly, his having broken a rib and not wanting to disappoint and, you know, drinking heavily to medicate. So
that was probably also, you know, that was around the time, I can't remember what's the date on strings?
1980. I think he might have visited twice, but I think they were actually made in 1980.
Yeah, he was still drinking then. You know, he did quit, but closer to his death. So I think probably 80 to 90 was enthusiastic.
Yeah, well, he had the excuse, which he didn't tell anyone about, of having really done damage. I mean, I think he...
Had a broken rib?
It's incredibly painful, right?
I've never either, but I've had friends, and they say it's hard to breathe.
Yeah. Well, he made those prints in that sort of pain, masked with Glenn Levitz. So it's true.
Oh. I want to return to the artist Conk for a second, just because I don't know if I ever told you this, but so as you say, things not seen before. So these are really something like the artist Conks are totally unknown to people. Like I had never seen one, you had never seen one.
Yeah.
And when you came and we saw them, and Emmy went home and with great enthusiasm told her parents. Did I ever tell you this story?
You mentioned in your blog, but you
should
tell it.
That's right, I did. But it was just so incredibly serendipitous that her father, Bob Martin, who was on the board of the John Cage Trust for a long time and also was the founding director of the conservatory here at Bard, he's now slightly retired. He'll never retire, but he's living in Germany, but he'll be home, he'll be back, and he's moving to Pennsylvania, he and his wife, Catherine. But anyway, I digress. Emmy, in her enthusiasm, telling her parents about this conch, Bob pads in his stocking feet at his home here on the campus and comes back with his own artist conch, which he hands to Emmy. And it's sketches of, I forget now exactly what, I could look it up. It's a cello.
There's no notation, right?
Of Beethoven, a little bit music notation. It's a Beethoven cello sonata, which Bob is a cellist, was in the Sequoia Quartet for a long time. And he brings this and hands it to Emmy. And she said, "What in the world is this?" And he said, "It's my artist conch." And she said, "Why do you have this?" And he said, "I made it for Catherine when we were courting." And they had kept it in the bedroom closet for, I don't know how long it's been there. I don't know how long they've been married, but I want to say 50, 60 years, you know? So these things do last.
I'm happy to hear that. I've been worried about how to treat it.
Yeah, I don't think you have to baby it. I don't know why I think that, but anyway, we're going to stop now. I'm glad that we've had a few minutes more together to kind of talk about this show. We still haven't talked about Steps, but I think maybe when you're in Asheville and I'm in Asheville and Ray Cass is going to be in Asheville, maybe we'll do another radio program with him around Steps.
I think that might be a really sweet idea.
So we can talk about that. And you can fill us in on Lawrence Wojtek's beautiful performance in Fort Myers.
Will be included.
Excellent, Jade. It's so great to spend more time with you today.
The same. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's nice to see you.
You're welcome. Happy 4th of July.
Same to you.
Being opportunistic as I am, I'd like now to play something having nothing to do with the wonderful Jade Dellinger, but rather is a little known pre-concert talk that certainly fits in the things not heard before category by the American composer, keyboardist, and improviser Richard Teitelbaum. Richard gave this talk at the opening of our John Cage at Bard College Symposium that took place here at Bard College in 2009. He was a student of Alan Fort, Mel Powell, and Luigi Nono, and well known for his live electronic music and synthesizer performances. He was also a pioneer of brainwave music and used Japanese, Indian, and Western classical instruments and notation in both composition and improvisational settings. Richard taught at Bard College from 1988 until his death in 2020. I was reminded of him on hearing of the death this past week of Frederick Jevsky, who, as many of you probably know, with Richard Teitelbaum, was responsible for the formation of the important live acoustic electronic improvisation group formed in 1966 in Rome, known as Musica Electronica Viva, or MEV. Richard was a close friend to John Cage and Merce Cunningham. He was a wonderful colleague, and I hope you enjoy his talk as much as those in attendance did.
Hello. Good evening. My name is Richard Teitelbaum. I'm a teacher here at Bard. And this isn't really a formal pre-concert talk. It's just I've had these little stories I wrote about Cage about 15 years ago, I think. And I've never shown them to anybody, and I decided maybe this was the occasion. I think I've read them in a couple of John Cage classes that I teach every couple of years, but this is a kind of maiden presentation. So they are appropriately titled Some Memories of John Cage. I first met John Cage when I was a graduate student at Yale University around 1962 or 63. I was studying theory and composition and was invited by Alan Fort, one of my teachers at the music school, to organize a series of lectures by visiting composers and theorists. We'd already received a letter from Karlheinz Stockhausen's agent announcing a U.S. tour, and Stockhausen became the first speaker on the series. Typically, Stockhausen had demanded a minimum of $150, and as I was given only a total of $300 to cover all four lectures, I was able to offer Cage only $50. He wrote back that if I could make it $75, he could bring David Tudor as well and perform his newest work, but I foolishly replied that we could only afford the $50. And that is how John Cage, at the age of 50, made his first appearance at the Yale Music School for $50. Unlike Stockhausen, who also demanded the highest quality equipment to play his tapes, and then took great delight in blowing out one of the audiophile speakers we had borrowed from the local hi-fi store, "Those little impulses, they go right through the speakers," he later boasted gleefully to us terrified students. John, on the other hand, made do with three low-priced Wollensock tape, reel-to-reel tape decks with built-in speakers that he spread out across the front of the stage in Sprague Hall and used the rather cheesy mic and PA system in the hall to amplify his voice. The piece he performed was the simultaneous lecture, "Where Are We Going, What Are We, and What Are We Doing?" that had just been published in Silence the year before. The performance lasted quite a long time, perhaps 45 minutes to an hour. I had never heard any Cage performances previously, and frankly, I couldn't quite say whether I liked or disliked it, but I recall very distinctly that I had the sense that after about half an hour or so, something had happened to my consciousness that was unlike anything I had ever experienced. There were a good number of people in the audience, many from outside the music school. Cage was then much better known in the art and architecture school where I think he had previously appeared. The audience included a large contingent of undergraduates brought in by Professor Paul Weiss, then the reigning aesthetician in the philosophy department, who had primed his students for attack. In the ensuing question period, Weiss and his students did their best to jump all over John, questioning what rules govern the composition of the piece and why couldn't anybody compose this just as well as John, to which he replied, "You can, go ahead and do it." After that, I drove with John up to the reception in his honor, where others, including the hostess, continued to confront him. "What you do is psychology, not music," was one of the charges I recall. En route to the reception, John said, "You know, Weiss wants me to make rules for what I do, to make a school. I don't want to do that. Why, last week I heard Lamont Young hit a gong 511 times. It was magnificent, but I never would have thought of that. If I had made a school, perhaps that might never have happened. It was the first of many unforgettable lessons I learned from John Cage. The next performance I saw did include David Tudor. It was Variations 2, performed at Charlotte Moorman's New York Avant-Garde Festival in Steinway Hall on 57th Street. It was also the first live electronic performance I had ever seen. Tudor played the piano, though actually never on the keyboard. Rather, he was crawling around under the piano with various contact mics and pickups, culling an astonishing array of sounds from the piano's innards. While this somewhat less dignified than I was used to piano performance was going on, Cage sat very formally at the table, very slowly and purposely performing a variety of everyday activities, lighting a cigarette, tapping ashes into an ashtray, writing with a pen and paper, all highly amplified by contact mics. After David's activities had built up to a huge roar, John slowly raised a glass of water to his lips and took a drink, whereupon a sound like Niagara Falls suddenly roared forth behind the audience, the first time I was aware of any sound from back there, with startling and even terrifying effect. I remember spinning around and practically jumping out of my seat. I was not the only one jumping up and down, though I was sitting in the second row of this very small hall and could see quite well. There was a very excited elderly gentleman directly in front of me who was constantly bobbing up and down to get an even better view of the proceedings. It was Edgar Varèse. During 1970 and 71, I studied in the World Music Program at Wesleyan, and Cage was also there as a fellow of the Center for Advanced Studies, where I remember John organizing and leading games of red light, green light in the hallways. One night, John arranged a dinner party at a very simple but excellent family-style restaurant called Blessings in New Haven for a group of people that included both the distinguished director of the center, who was an Arab, and myself. In a small private back room, John sat at the head of the table and placed the two of us on either side of him. He had called ahead to order a specialty of the house that took some considerable advance preparation, about which he had been quite secretive. When the main course arrived, John grandly served out large portions to each of us, as well as everyone else, with considerable flourish. It turned out to be mostly a kind of stewed pig fat, and John took kind of devilish pleasure in dishing it out to the Arab and the Jew on either side of him, both of whom looked somewhat green, but were too polite to decline generous helpings of this great delicacy. I think John thought he was making some kind of contribution to world peace and understanding, the Arabs and Jews breaking pork together. Among other memorable events of that year was the student strike to protest the bombing of Cambodia. I recall a wonderful lecture that John improvised on education, saying, among other things, that the kind of anarchic environment created by the strike, with students milling about freely but engaged in small and intense discussions and debates all over the campus, was an ideal one for an educational situation. A year later, when I visited CalArts for a job interview, during its first year at the Burbank campus of the Villa Cabrini before the new building in Valencia had been completed, the freeform atmosphere there was similar. One other indelible image that comes to mind from that Wesleyan year took place while waiting for a lecture by Bucky Fuller to begin, with some 1,000 students seated mostly on the floor of the large modern glass building where Fuller was to speak. John and Anthony Braxton, who had come up from New York to visit Barbara Mayfield and myself, stood lost in a game of chess they were playing on a tiny pocket chess set they held in their hands. John, being a bit tipsy at the time, was losing badly. In the mid-70s, Namjoon Paik made a TV program on John for public television that included a special version of 433 based on performing I Ching operations on a map of Manhattan. In this way, John chose several locations around the city to record and videotape the sounds and sights at each spot. I drove my VW van with John perched on the front seat and Namjoon, Shigeko Kubota, and cameraman Judd Yalkut in the back. The chosen spots turned out to be at far-flung ends of the city, and the traffic was horrendous, with much sudden starting and stopping. At one point, someone urged John to use his seatbelt, but he declined to do so, saying, "Buckminster Fuller says, between rigidity and flexibility, choose flexibility. I never use seatbelts." While stuck in the worst and most exasperating of the traffic jams, I asked John how, in accordance with his Buddhist beliefs in the beauty of all things, he could find it in this present situation. "Well," he replied, "the only reason you wouldn't find it beautiful is because you want to be somewhere else. If you accept being here, it's really very interesting. Look at the patterns of all those flashing brake lights. Listen to the sounds of the rhythms and the rhythms of all the different car horns." Before I ever met Cage, I had heard many unusual stories about him and his ideas while I was still a student at Yale. The general line taken there about Cage was that he was just plain crazy. As proof of that, my composition teacher, Mel Powell, recounted that once when he asked Cage why he had made the silent piece just 4 minutes and 33 seconds long, he replied that at the time he wrote it, there were only 78 RPM records, and that was the maximum length of one side of a disc. Many years later, Sidney Cowell told me that once, many years earlier, when Cage and her late husband and one of Cage's principal teachers, Henry Cowell, were driving across the country, they stopped for lunch in a diner, and chagrined at the selections that were constantly being played on the jukebox, Cowell proposed that someone should put out a disc, 78 of course, with only silence on it. Though I was generally very shy around John, I did turn to him for help on several occasions. Once, when many years ago I had gotten into an upsetting row with one of my colleagues, I went to see him for advice. He and Merce unexpectedly, but with typical kindness and generosity, invited me to stay for dinner and got us all quite drunk. The only thing I can recall from the evening was John urging me to, quote, "always try to be as charming as possible." Excellent advice I am still trying to master. On another occasion, when I needed a rehiring recommendation for Bard, after much hesitation, I called to ask John to write one for me. He said that as he had need to talk to President Botstein on another matter, he would call him personally. Leon later recounted that he was so astonished and incredulous when his secretary told him that John Cage was on the line that he had replied, "Sure, sure, and Albert Einstein, too." On August 12, 1992, I went out to the swimming hole across the road from my house in Bearsville to sit on my regular spot, take a swim, and meditate on the setting sun, my usual routine each summer afternoon. On reaching it, I discovered to my horror that it was occupied by the body of a decapitated possum, an animal of such sweetness and innocence. Somewhat in shock on finding such a bizarre and grisly sight exactly on the spot that I held somehow sacred, I quickly returned home, thinking to call Sidney Cowell, my neighbor and advisor on wildlife and the widow of John Cage's teacher, Henry Cowell. Before I could call her, Sidney called me. My phone machine was still on, and I heard her say, "This is Sidney. I felt I wanted to tell you that John Cage died this afternoon at 2:30. The next day or so, I lay around kind of paralyzed in a state of sadness and shock. I couldn't decide what to do, whether to go to New York to the concert of Cage's music that had been previously scheduled in the MoMA Sculpture Garden the next night. Somehow, I had the notion that I didn't want to erase Sidney's message from the tape. I decided to fast forward the tape to the end, turn it over, and use the other side for future messages. Almost as an afterthought, it occurred to me to check if anything was on that side. I pushed play, and out came John's voice saying, "Hi, Richard, this is John Cage." As I listened, I started to cry and laugh at the same time. Here is the whole conversation, which was accidentally recorded by my machine.
Hi, Richard, this is John Cage. I'm at 212-98.
Hello, John.
Hi.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Well, I'm all right, I have a bit of a cold, so I've been staying in.
Uh-huh. Richard, you remember when there was that concert up near Albany and you came years ago?
Near Albany?
You were with a friend.
Gee.
And he was out in the country Carlton Clay had arranged it.
Oh.
And they played a piece of mine called, which was very early, a composition for three voices. Do you have any memory of it at all?
No. Was this in Oneonta? Oh, yes, 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 yes. I do remember.
And it was a brass piece, wasn't it?
A piece of yours was a brass piece?
It was called
Composition for Three Voices.
And it was very chromatic.
Yes, uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I do remember.
Wasn't it all brass?
Well, now that I don't quite remember.
You don't?
Gee. I was asleep, John, so I might remember in a few minutes.
Oh,
but,
you were asleep just now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, not during your piece. No.
Weren't you asleep at the concert?
No, not in the concert. I mean, maybe if I was asleep in the concert, I'd remember it while now and I'm asleep also.
Well, it's nice to hear your voice.
Well, you can't remember what your piece was written for?
It wasn't written for any instruments. It was.
Oh, I see, and they did it. Uh-huh.
And they played it.
Yeah, I think it was brass. I think they did it for
I think it was brass.
Yeah, I think so.
But I look up the ranges of the brass, and they don't fit my notes.
Uh-huh. Well, can't we get a hold of Carlton Clay and ask him?
I asked him.
And what did he say?
And he didn't remember.
How about Sydney? Did she remember?
No, I just spoke with her.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, was she along? I don't think she was.
No, but I think she listened on the radio or something like that. Huh. Well, I'll try to jog my memory when I'm a little more awake.
Okay.
Are you home these days?
Uh-huh.
How are you?
Too well. I have an itchiness.
Really? What's what?
My skin, and I think it's related to poor digestion.
Oh, dear.
I've been traveling too much and didn't eat the right food.
Uh-oh. Did the doctor give you any diagnosis?
Yes, he said I should eat properly.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't do this, that, and the other.
Uh-huh. So can you stay home for a while now?
Yes, I hope to.
Well, please take care of yourself.
Okay.
Take care, John. I hope to see you.
You too, Richie.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.